The topic is the Lion of Judah, Hadar, Jewish Pride and Self-Defense. And much of this is influenced by an incredible book that many of you may have read recently about Menachem Begin. Came out a few years ago, Menachem Begin, The Battle for Israel's Soul by Daniel Gordis. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's fantastic. Picking up many of the themes in the Prime Ministers, but also explores many, many new ideas as well. And before I go into that theme, in the opening chapter or two, he develops the core of what this idea that really empowered the life of Menachem Begin, that is the theme of Hadar. We'll define Hadar in just a moment. He was a student, of course, of the Russian Jewish revisionist Zionist founder of Beitar, Hatzar, Nirgun, Zev Jabotinsky. And I don't have a source sheet. I don't have a source sheet. It's fine. I'll be fine without it.
Thank you.
And we're all familiar, of course, with the anthem, the State of Israel, Hatikva. But Beitar had its own anthem, its own theme song, if you will. And I want to share it with you. And it's here in the front. Beitar. Migovri kavon v'afar bedam uv'yeza yukam lanu geza geon v'nadi v'achzar beitar hanilkada yodefes masada tarmona boaz v'adar hadam. From the pit of decay and dust, with blood and sweat, shall arise a race, proud, generous and cruel. Capture beitar yodefet masada. Shall arise again in all their strength and glory. Hadar. Ivri gam ba'oni gam sar. Im eved im helech. Notzarta ben melech. Bekeser David keter David ne'etar. Ba'or vaseter zechor et haketer. Ateret geon v'tagar. Even in poverty, a Jew is a prince. Whether slave or tramp, you've been created with the son of kings. Crowned with the diadem of David. Whether in light or in darkness, always remember the crown of pride and tagar. Tagar. Al komat soro meitzar, im ta'alo tered, belav hamered, saw eish latzit ein davar, ki sheket hu refesh, hefker dam vanefesh, leman ahod hanistar, lamut olichbosh et ahar, yodafat masada beitar. Tagar, through all obstacles and enemies, whether you go up or down, in the flames of revolt, carry the flame to kindle. Never mind, for silence is filth. Worthless is blood and soul, the sake of the hidden glory. To die or conquer the hill, Yodefet Masada Beitar. This anthem obviously differs greatly, of course, from the anthem we're familiar with. It is this Beitar anthem with its historical references to Masada Yodfat, which Jews chose to commit suicide rather than to give in, submit to the Roman forces, as Gordis writes. When you compare this to Hatikva, another anthem which emerged at the same time from Europe, which existed and ultimately was adopted, so you find a stark difference. Kolo baleva penima, as long as in the heart within, nevesh Yehudi, Sophia, right? The Jewish soul yearns, and beyond towards the end of the east, an eye gazes towards Zion, ayin letzion, Sophia, sorry, it was homia before. Odo, I didn't write it down here. So Odo avda tikvatenu, our hope is not yet lost. The tikva that is bat shnat alpayim, right? Liot am chofshi be'artzeinu, to be a free nation, our land, and the land of Zion, Jerusalem. So the Hatikva is filled with all kinds of nice emotions of hope, of yearning, an old hope rekindled in a time, especially meaningful 2,000 years later, when Jews are starting to experience a hope that they never thought would happen. And so it has religious significance, of course, but mostly the emphasis in Hatikva, the one that was selected, and we understand why it was selected, if you have to choose, it's non-militaristic in nature. It highlights less concrete, more emotional attachment to the land of Israel, to its nation. kol od belevav, as long as we hope in the heart, as long as the heart yearns. To quote Gordas, he writes, this is not the worldview expressed in the Beitar Anthem. Beitar Anthem, how would you summarize it? What is the main theme? Strength, Jewish pride, nationalism, self-defense. What is Hadar? What is this thing, this notion of Hadar, which so empowered the life and the career of Menachem Begin? So here's a quote from Jabotinsky's Rayon Beitar in 1929. Hadar is a Hebrew word which hardly is at all translatable into another language. It combines various conceptions such as outward beauty, respect, self-esteem, politeness, faithfulness. The only suitable translation into the language of real life must be the Beitari, in his dealings, actions, speech, and thought. Naturally, we are all as yet removed from such a state of things, and in one generation cannot be achieved. Nevertheless, Hadar Beitar must be the daily goal of each one of us. Our every step, gesture, word, action, and thought must always be strictly executed from the Hadar viewpoint. Let me skip a little bit in the article. If such is the case, we Jews are the most aristocratic people in the world. He goes on to define that the difference between Jew and everyone else is that we have to be people of self-respect. We have to be people of nobility, of majesty. And he says, if that's the case, that we indeed are an aristocratic people. Even the most ancient of ruling dynasties have to their credit not more than 20 to 30 generations of culture. Further, somewhere at the beginnings, we find the best a medieval half-savage peasant. This is why Jabotinsky is not as popular nowadays. Or a robber. Jews, however, have 70 generations of man in the past. Men who could read and write, men who studied and discussed God, history, ideas of justice, human problems, and the future. In this sense, every Jew is a prince. And the bitterest of all jokes that the diaspora played on us, that the Jews are generally considered as hailing from God knows where. The joke that a Jew who he says is such a prince, is such a magisterial being, is yet somehow being depicted by the world as the filth, the refuse, as is famously depicted in Megillas Eicha. We were the trash of the world. We were the trash. And so Begin took this lesson from his Rebbe, from Jabotinsky, and it really did fuel his career. A few important quotes and highlights of his career of what Hadar means. The great summary of the book, an article that was written a number of months back by Michael Rosen. I could send you the link if you like. He quotes a few of these instances, and there's some others here. In 1946, British mandatory forces began flogging various captured Irgun fighters. It was a mess what was going on. Jews who wanted to defend themselves from the British mandate, who were being promised that kind of defense but weren't really being handed real defense. Of course, nobody was doing anything about the would-be to millions of Jews, the final Jews who were going to be murdered, which Begin and others were fighting so desperately to encourage the British mandate to bring into the land. In the meantime, those who are defending the Jewish people from the Arab onslaught, from the terrorism, are now being flogged and humiliated and beaten in public. And Begin calls out, the not-so-British General Barker authorized the humiliating flogging punishment that was imposed on the Hebrew soldier. We now warn, if oppressors dare to injure the body or the personnel or national honor of young Hebrews, we will not respond with the whip, we will respond with fire. Sounded like fighting words, but he was defending Jewish lives. And he said, we've been through this already, right? Throughout history. And no longer do we need, post-Holocaust, do we need to worry about the Jew and the image of the Jew being the refuse, being the one who gets flogged and humiliated in public. It's not just to be killed. It's to be humiliated was something that he was so terrified of. Independence Day, he delivers in 1948 one of his most memorable speeches. And Begin said, this event, look in Source 3, has occurred after 70 generations of dispersion, unending wandering of an unarmed people, after a period of almost total destruction of the Jew as a Jew. We shall go on our way into battle, soldiers of the Lord of hosts, inspired by the spirit of our ancient heroes. From the conquerors of Canaan to the rebels of Judah, on a simplistic level, it sounds like he is inspired by great Jewish wars, Jewish battles. But you'll see in a moment that it's not just that. When Jerusalem was reunified, 1967, Begin, of course, cautioned the cabinet, and he said, we cannot use the word capture. We're not capturing Jerusalem. What are we doing? We're liberating Jerusalem. He said, if you're not going to use that, minimally you have to speak about the old city of Jerusalem, the city of David, as being in the hands of the IDF. That language, of course, was tweaked a little bit. Now, the next day, famously, we hear over and over again, Har Habayit Bi'adenu. Temple Mount is in our hands. That was Begin. That was the Jabotinsky, the Hadar in him. The idea that something that is ours has been restored to us. We didn't capture something. And of course, not only did he influence Eshkol in this way, he also, of course, told him that when they get there, they have to recite the Shir HaMalos, recite in 126, Psalm 126, right? When the Jewish people return from the exiles of Zion. And they say the Brach of Shechianu. He saw this as a momentous religious occasion. And finally, another illustration in his career on the Knesset floor, when in the 50s, when Ben-Gurion was pushing to accept reparations from Germany, his argument was, this is a financially sound plan. Accept money because we need it. We're a fledgling country. We need the cash. And not necessarily that it would be an overture indicating forgiveness, but that we need the money. And so it was what would get Israel on its feet. And Begin vehemently opposed this. And he said, in some of his harshest words, the Gentiles did not just hate us. They did not just murder us. They did not just incinerate us. They were not just jealous of us. Because most Jews stop there. We have to survive. And we need a state of Israel so we can live. Most important, they belittled us. And this was the most tragic thing of the Holocaust, according to Begin. Not that a Jew was killed, not that a Jew was gassed, not that a Jew was burnt, but that a Jew was reduced to refuse. That payas were cut off in public. They laughed and mocked us and made fun of our rituals. They belittled us. And in this generation that we call the last generation of submission and the first generation of redemption, in this generation in which we attained a measure of respect, in which we have moved from slavery to redemption, you are coming to rob us of little respect that we have managed to obtain. And he opposed, we know, to some extent he had an influence, but he opposed, therefore, accepting any reparations from Germany, not just because it would acquiesce or acknowledge that we have forgiven, but it will give up that hadar, that Jewish pride, that sense of we will not be belittled again. We have something, we've held on to some semblance of pride, self-assurity, and we will not give that up. I want to talk about this notion of Hadar. And there really is a conflict here that developed in the beginning of the state between the Begin and the Ben-Gurion world, right? Which seems, it of course develops into a greater period and two major different philosophies. But it's not as simplistic as self-defense versus passivity. You know, it's more of a question of which side of the Jew as a glorious entity do you emphasize? Is your hadar rooted in your might and your ability not to be pushed over? Or is the glory of the Jew being the Or LaGoyim that he is always seeking peace and always being the one? Now, they're both, I don't believe they're mutually exclusive. But I think these two paths developed into mutually exclusive paths and therefore created two diametrically opposed approaches. I want to show that, in fact, this is an old debate. This is an old discussion. And it goes back to the time of, it goes back really to the time of Shimon, Levi, of Yaakov. And before we even get into Shimon and Levi, we'll talk about Yaakov. When I introduced this idea, Parz Vayishlach, in my shul, there had been a statement that was sitting on my files for a while from Rav Shirky, was the leader of the Beit Yehuda community in Yerushalayim, and it was a statement that generated a lot of controversy. It was when the stabbings were first starting. Eitam and Naama Henkin were murdered, and he said here, and one of the things that we find is that Eitam's mother got up and said that we have to daven, we have to, is all spiritual response to the crisis. And he said the spiritual thing that's missing here is courage. The spiritual thing that we need to do is have courage. And we don't have courage, so we get agony. And don't be mistaken, he said, courage is spiritual. When you deal with small-minded Torah, suffering comes. You're slack-handed, you can't solve problems. He said, don't organize public prayers now and demonstrate. This is not the first time we heard someone say that. Right? God says to Moshe, when he's standing by the Yam Suf, stop davening, stop shuckling. Daber al bnei Yisrael v'yisol. This is the real answer. The real tshuva now is to learn self-defense. That's what Rav Shirky said. And people were furious. In particular, in the Haredi world, they were furious. And it's the first time and only time in history the Haredi world came to the defense of Chana Henkin. So it's an interesting little footnote in history. It's a good debate. What is that emphasis, right? This is the debate that plagues us nowadays in Israel. The role of the Haredim in the army. This is a good question. Spiritual investment, right? Not to say that Ben-Gurion was pioneering that or championing that cause. But the spiritual investment being viewed as a separate type of contribution to the militaristic or the self-defense, the self-pride one. So there is an interesting Rashi that we all know that preparing for war with Esav, Yaakov steps up and Yaakov decides he's going to do everything in his power. He's going to daven. He's going to prepare for war, and he's going to send a gift of appeasement. Right? Rashi says, and he quotes a different pasuk for each one, Hiskin atzmo lishlosha dvarim, ledoron, a gift, tefila, prayer, umochama. Sounds like the responsible thing to do. You don't know how a certain initiative is going to go. You're dealing with an enemy, potential enemy. You better prepare for the worst and for the best. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst, right? So the question is, right, do we take the Hatikva route, the hope route, or take the Hadar route? And Yaakov seems to weigh all possibilities and says, look, we have to be prepared for anything. Right? First, he's ambitious, he's filled with hope. Many great leaders have followed suit, go with an open hand, not a clenched fist. Right? We've heard this before. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But he's terrified. And then we read the pasuk, Vayiro Yaakov Me'od. Look at the next source. Yaakov feared. Vayetzer lo. Vayachat sesa'am, asharito, vesatzom, vesabakar, vagmalim, lishne machanot. This is not the move of a military genius. He splits the camp in two. Why? What's Yaakov thinking? He's afraid of Esav. He splits his people into two. What's the svara? What's the logic? Well, we're going to get killed by Esav. We might as well save half our people. So already, though he's prepared for war, his tactic seems weak. Right? Prepare for half of our people to die. It's a shocking approach. But it becomes more perplexing when you consider what happens next. And this is an insight from the Rashbam, which I found earlier this year. And when I saw this Rashbam, it blew my mind away. I can't believe I never saw this or heard this quoted before. Yaakov gets up in the middle of the night. Vayakom balayla hu vayikach eshtei nosha veshtei shivkosav ves'achar asar yiladav v'yavor eis ma'avor yabok. He takes his four wives, two shvachos. Takes his 12 children. He passes over this river. Where was he going? Unclear. Vayaver es asher lo. Vayivaser Yaakov levado v'yavek ishimo. Adalos shachar. He fights with a mysterious nemesis, this angel, till the morning. And he sees he can't do it. Vayar ki lo yachol lo. The angel sees that he couldn't defeat him. Vayigah b'kaf yericho. Vateka kaf yerech Yaakov be'avko imo. And he injures Yaakov. Yaakov is permanently damaged. We don't need the Gidanasha. Great story. What's the point of all this strange event? What is happening? Not only is this bizarre, one wonders what the connection between the fact that he seems to get up in the middle of the night. Vayakam balayla, first pasuk we read there. He gets up in the middle of the night, pasuk of Gimel. And then, subsequently, right, he makes this midnight traversal back across the river, and he starts to fight with this mysterious, elusive nemesis. So Rashbam presents a novel pirush. Let me share with you the Rashbam. Look at source 6. Vayakam balaylahu. He got up in the middle of the night. Where was he going? Yiskaven livroch derech cheres. Yaakov decided, with all the resolve in the world, to run away. He was afraid. We know he's afraid. We already read that in source 5. In source 4. Lefichach avar anacha balayla. He passed the middle of the night, because who runs away in the middle of the night? Someone who's terrified. Kimosh matzina b'David. David runs away from Avshalom. Also, he passes over a river, a body of water in the middle of the night. Fast, quickly. Vayomru el David, kumu ivru mehera samayim. Vayakam David b'chol ha'am asher itov yavru asayardin ad or aboker. David runs away from his son Avshalom in the middle of the night, echoing those words we find by Yaakov. Yaakov runs away in the middle of the night. He decides war is not an option. Sometimes that's the answer. And then look what the Rashbam writes. Look at the underlined part. For Yivasu Yaakov levado, he remains alone. Klamar shehevir is kol sherlo, shalaya od lavor elahu levado. He already passed everything over the river, and the only thing he had now to bring back was himself and a few, according to the Gemara, a few kalim he had left over. V'rotza lavor achareyam, ki livroch derech acheret shalo yifkishenu esav niskaven. Sounds like he decided he's going to run the other way. So Yaakov is moving one way. He's terrified. He's going in the middle of the night. And then he decides he's going to abandon everyone. And then all of a sudden, this angel shows up and starts to wrestle him. Malach imo shalo yuchal livroch v'yir akiyum habtach asosho kadosh baruch hu shalo yazikeu az esav. Hashem sends this malach to fight with Yaakov to remind him of the promise that he will not let Esav defeat him. Otherwise, says the Rashbam, something radical that if we didn't see it from the words of our Rishonim, we wouldn't be able to say it. Yaakov was running away and he left his family. Yaakov was abandoning his mission. His resolve had crumbled. Here's a quote I saw from Rav Chanoch Waxman from the Gush website. We may conclude that the story of the struggle really constitutes a story of frustrated flight. At the last minute, Yaakov wavers. God sends the angel, seizes Yaakov, forces him to meet Esav. Yaakov is injured, preventing his flight and symbolizing his disobedience. Why is Yaakov punished based on the Rashbam, according to Rav Waxman? Because Yaakov tried to run away. Again, I wouldn't say it myself, but this is the way the Rashbam sees it. Now, we understand Yaakov is an ish tam yoshev olam. He doesn't like war. He prefers the Jewish modality of peace, which I think we all do in theory. But he's criticized by God for not being brave, for not having the courage to believe that God is going to redeem him from Esav. And he says, I'm going to show you that you could fight. And he gives him a war of independence. He gives him a 6-day war. And he shows him, wait, look what you're made of. He taught him Jewish pride. That was the purpose of sending the angel the way of Yaakov. The story continues, actually, because the most dreaded moment that Yaakov had been working towards, what kept him up all night long, ends up being an anticlimactic moment. What happens when he finally confronts the sum of all his fears? What happens when he finally confronts Esav, his brother, Hatzilein and Am Yarachim Yad Esav? What happens when he sees him face to face? The dreaded moment that he'd been thinking about for years. I'm sure he didn't sleep in the house of his father-in-law. It's a very innocuous meeting at worst. Vayarad Esav likrosa vayichabkehu vayipol tzavarav vayishakehu vayibchu. Esav greets him, he reaches out to him, brother, they cry on each other's shoulder. It's no different than the teary-eyed reunion we find by the brothers of Yosef and his brothers. It's a beautiful moment. Chazal, of course, turned Esav into a villain. I'm not saying there is not basis, there is plenty of basis, of course. He is the founder of Rome, he is the predecessor to Rome, even though they don't come from Esav physically, lineage-wise. They're related to Esav in Chazal. Everyone who persecutes us, who tortures us, who tries to kill us, they're Esav. The rule of Chazal says Esav's son is Yaakov, but Lamais, the last thing we see of Esav, is what is he trying to do? He's hugging us, embracing us. And there's the famous Medrash that he tried to bite Yaakov, and then Yaakov's neck turned to stone. Of course, this is one of the approaches in our Masorah. But there's another approach in our Masorah, and that is the Bereishis Rabbah. Malamech nichmeru rachama be'osa shav v'nashku b'chaliba. Why are there dots over Vayishakehu? Right? Because it wasn't a half-hearted kiss. Rather, because it was a whole-hearted kiss. It was a real kiss. And he put teeth in the kiss. Meaning, it was really wholehearted. Esav really was broken over what had happened. And for a brief moment, we get this messianic glimpse into what life could have been like if these two brothers actually were partners. It's an amazing vision. It's an amazing concept when you think about it, that Esav and Yaakov could have got along. They could have been one. We like to paint the image of Esav as a monster. But in this story, the pshat, the simple reading, we have to read pshat, it's the opposite. Yaakov lacks resolve, says the Rashbam. And Esav still has a warm place in his heart reserved for Yaakov. Yaakov is panicked, and Esav is making peace. Yaakov's pacifism, the Ish Tam, Yoshev Olam, is very much a dominant force. He doesn't want war, he doesn't know war, he wants to be left alone until God wakes him up by sending an emissary his way. But even after the showdown, I think Yaakov is still ill-prepared to face the harshness of the world which surrounds him, almost as he doesn't want to admit the way the world looks at the Jew. We come to Shechem, and his own daughter, the only daughter that's named in Chumash, is abducted, is raped, and the Jewish name is disgraced, and Hadar is trampled on. And in the face of that, Yaakov is silent. He tries to negotiate, and it's one approach, it's one posture, and we don't know who's right, to be honest. Some Mepharshim take the Yaakov camp, some Mepharshim sit in the Shimon V'Levi camp, and Shimon V'Levi turns to their father, he criticizes him, he says, why do you do this to me? They went and they tore apart Shechem, and they killed every man. And they humiliated them, and they shed unnecessary blood. And they claimed it was necessary blood, because Hachazona Yase et Achotenu, shall our sister, says Yaakov, says Shimon and Levi, become a prostitute? Jewish Hadar was at risk, Jewish pride, Jewish dignity. And what's the famous response of Yaakov? The parak ends. There is no response. What may we conclude from that debate? Maybe they have a point. Maybe they're still wrong, but maybe they have a point. Some Mepharshim, like I said, say Shimon and Levi are correct. The Rambam has an interesting approach where he says that could be they were right. What emerges is debate over two modalities of Jews. The one who sits and hopes for peace, hopes for a time when nobody will rape Jews, and nobody will blow up buses and commit stabbings, when the civility and the beauty of what it means to be a woman means you're not going to walk up to a guard and pretend to ask directions and pull out a knife and stab them. But that's not reality. We're dreaming, Hatikva, and our enemies are barbaric. And there comes a time for Shimon Velevi's voice to be heard as well. For a Begin to stand on the floor of the Knesset and say that sometimes enough is enough. That's not the problem that Germany incinerated us. It's the problem that they belittled us. And that debate, something interesting happens. Yaakov goes on and curses Shimon Velevi on his deathbed. But Levi does fairly well later on. What's the future of Levi? What happens with Levi later on? Who does he become? Comes the Kohen. Kihuna. How does Shimon do? So together it's a problem. It's a little too much violence, right? But Levi does fairly well. In fact, there's one prominent descendant of Levi who gets a promotion because of his violent tendencies. Who's that? Pinchas. Pinchas, who is the son of Elazar HaKohen, who is the son of Aaron HaKohen, who's a descendant of Levi. Pinchas pulls out the sword of Shechem, still dripping with the blood, still wet with the blood of Shechem, and he kills even one of his own. And he becomes a national hero. And he acts in a time when even Moshe, according to the Gemara, was suffering from paralysis. Nobody could move. And Pinchas steps up. And yet, Shimon, and this is an interesting chiluk, what happens to Shimon? Shimon, actually, Shlumiel ben Tzurishadai, is from Meshevet. His other name, his code name, because we don't want to give his name there, is Zimri. What happens to Zimri?
He gets buried.
Well, before him, what did he do? He's engaged in an immoral act with Cosby. Again, this is the first time Cosby was caught engaged in an immoral act. This continues many times in recent history. Anyway, where was I? There was no hiding this event. This took place in front of everyone. And Shlumiel, whose name means Shlumiel, because he kind of gets busted for doing what everyone else is doing. So that's what the Shlumiel is, right? Shlumiel. That's Shimon. Levi acts in a way that dignifies him. And Levi and Shimon come head to head later on. Levi is glorified and Shimon is not. And what's the difference? And I think the difference is because we think all violence, all bloodshed, and all war is somehow evil. In its truest sense, it is. Lo yisa goya gocharev, right? All the nevuos of the future when pacifism will reign supreme, when nobody will fight. It's a great day. It's a great dream. It's a great vision. And I'll come back to that in a second. But in the end, sometimes you need to pull midas Esav. In the end, sometimes you need that sacred partnership, that vision when Esav's koach. So what would have happened if we had Esav? Think about it for a second. What if we had koach of Esav? We've had no problem, of course, facing Lavan. That would have been a cinch. Right? Mm-hmm. Lavan tries to switch wives. No problem. Here's my sword. We've had no problem with Shechem. Been great. We've had no problem throughout history. All those people tried to bully us, beat us, abuse us, kill us, and rape us and torture us. Because we have our ace. We have our hero. We have our warrior. Yaakov can sit in the tent because we embrace the Midas Esav as not being a foreign concept. But Chazal took the other route because we saw so much bloodshed from the Romans. Esav became synonymous with the Romans. And any time someone picks up a sword, it's evil. I don't want to get into the whole gun debate. It's not important for now. But you think about the way in which we associate symbols of violence with actual violence, and we think it's all negative. But if only we had an Esav, if only that vision, that utopian moment in Tanakh, when Esav and Yaakov were together, if that vision, the side by side, yes, he would have had to marry Leah. But what life would have been how glorious the Jewish name would have been if nobody would mess with us. If every second in history we were known throughout the world like we were in 1967. Yes, we had to kill people in 1967. But the Jewish name was the top in the world. Everybody respected us and revered us. And what happens the moment we start accepting reparations, the moment we start apologizing for being proud to be Jewish, they trample all over us. Oh, it's not enough land. Give us some more land. Who are you? Just a Jew. And they belittle us. The same governing body who granted us the State of Israel, the UN, they're our worst enemy. How is that possible? Because we don't believe in ourselves anymore. We don't have pride. We don't have the hadar. We're lacking the entity. We're lacking what Esav would have brought us. And so when it comes to Shimon Levi, there's an interesting dynamic. And here's the chiluk. And this, I think, is an important chiluk. Shimon ends up, his descendant, Shlumiel ben Tzurishaddai, acts out of lust and visceral emotion. And if you act out of visceral emotion in the moment, that's not glory. That's just bloodshed and bloodlust, and that's revenge, that's not beautiful. But when it's calculated anger, that of Pinchas, I hate to do this, but I have to kill you. That's a different story. That's pride, self-defense. That's the worst thing in the world I would ever want to do, is go into war. But I'm not going to be afraid to do so if I have to. If it means my children will be disgraced, then I'm not going to be a pacifist in that moment. That's why Levi emerges from the curse of Yaakov and becomes Pinchas, and Shimon doesn't. And here's the chiluk, by the way, brought up by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in a different venue. Those going to my shiur know this great quote here. It's in the last source 13, the last source. Rav Aaron was talking about, after the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, one of the low points, I would say, according to many of Begin's critics in his career, though, of course, Begin claims it was, and the massacres did not take place by Jewish hands, these were Christians, but he was critiqued for being at the helm at the time, certainly Sharon, and it certainly marred the reputation of Begin, and certainly destroyed what Hadar was supposed to be about. But anyway, he's writing here, they wrote a letter, and he asked, why is it that King Shaul was punished? This is the downside of Hadar. Why was King Shaul punished when he refused to kill Agag? Remember the story, Hashem says, wipe out Amalek. Shaul shows up, he kills all Amalek, and keeps the king alive, and a few sheep. And the famous play on words, the onomatopoeia in Tanakh, Meh kol atzon, what is the voice of the sheep? Meh is the bleeding of the sheep. It's a famous play on words in Tanakh. If you kill them, where are the sheep? Why are there sheep here? Why is Agag alive? And of course, why does Shaul keep Agag alive? It's a good question. Why does Hashem get so angry? After all, Shaul HaMelech was acting in a merciful way. You spare a king, it's the way of the world. So why is Hashem so angry that Shaul spares Agag? He did kill 99.9% of the nation off. Now, it's true Agag got someone pregnant in the meantime. Haman is born, comes from there. Amalek, right? It's true. But why is he so angry? So Rav Aaron says something I think brilliant and very unique, and it's a debatable point. He said, by saying I'm not going to kill Agag, it calls to question the very ethical nature of killing in general, which is fundamentally wrong. It's wrong. Bloodshed is wrong. So Shaul said, I'm opposed to bloodshed. So why did he kill everyone else in Amalek? By killing everyone else in Amalek and not killing Agag, what does he show? That his motivations were to fulfill some sort of bloodlust, some sort of vengeance against the people he hated. No, you're not allowed to kill Amalek because you hate Amalek. There's only one reason that justifies the act of killing Amalek, an entire nation, and that's because God said so. Otherwise, it's completely irrational and wrong. So by sparing someone, he says, this is an ethical thing, this is my decision. Amalek, they deserve it. But Agag doesn't. It's suggesting that the reason you killed in the first place was to fulfill some sort of emotional, visceral need. And there you get the difference between Shimon and Levi. Shimon massacres Shechem because Hachazon Anasach Otenu was a second thought. It's that these people did it to our sister. And therefore, we're going to get vengeance. And Levi does it because Achotenu, we cannot have our sister shamed. It's a different story. It's the difference between violence and Hadar. Violence is about filling some sort of visceral emotional need, and Hadar is about bolstering the Jewish reputation and the majesty of the Jewish people as the prince of the world, who wears the diadem, the crown that Jabotinsky spoke about in his poem. And on this note, I want to close with, I think, a misunderstanding in the vision of the future. Keep in mind, the invoking of Beitar. When was Beitar destroyed? The Gemara's in Gittin. We just did the Daf Yomi recently. Nun Hey, Nun Vav, Nun Zion. Those Gemaras have one theme. And if you go through the Gemaras, you'll see tons of stories, horrible stories, each one getting worse and worse. Stories just end, each one is more heartbreaking. The failure of the Jewish morality, the failure of the Jewish people, but there's also the military story. And one uprising failed after another. Beitar is squashed. And people like Begin glorified the Beitar movement. Now, there's a story there, there's an underlying story that a Rebbe of mine once pointed out, Rebbe Taragin once noted, is that there's a chiluk. The chiluk is as follows. Everything in that Gemara is either a gross overreaction or a gross underreaction. Everything. Right? The whole concept of our concept story is a bunch of people going crazy over an invite. And then, in the process, a bunch of rabbis, Gedolei Dor, sitting there saying nothing, underreaction. Overreaction, underreaction. And the Gemara says, Mishum anvasnu so, shel Rabbi Zchari ben Avkulos, hechrivet beitenu, v'sreifa techaleinu, v'glitanu me'artzeinu. Because Rabbi Zchari ben Avkulos did nothing, he was too meek. And then, there's the overreaction of the Beryonim, who turned what could have been peaceful peace into violence by destroying the warehouses of flour, of grain. Everybody's overreacting or underreacting. It's either extreme violence, you attack the daughter of the Kesar because some cockamamie minhag about two trees, that they used to plant two trees and make a chuppah, and one day they cut down the tree that belonged to someone's chuppah, and they attack the daughter of the Kesar. So no wonder everything was destroyed. Overreaction. That's fulfilling some sort of lust, emotional, visceral need. That's Shimon, that's not Levi, that's not Hadar. But to sit idly by and watch yourself be slaughtered, to do nothing, that's also not Hadar. It's that balance between Yaakov, Koko Yaakov, and Yadayim de Esav we need. We need that glorious moment in history when the two of them actually worked in tandem. Remember the final piece of the Nevuah of the future, where it says, V'gar ze'ev im keves v'namer im gedi yirbatz v'egel chafir umari yachta v'nar katon no'egmam. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and the little child will lead them. What do we see when we read this? We have to remember something very important. That the future doesn't involve no lion at all. It involves a lion and a lamb. It has the vision of Yaakov and Esav, somehow bringing that broken family of Yitzchak, broken family of Avram back together again. It's a tough thought, but according to the Rashbam, we have to say it. And one day the lion will be part of who we are. The glory of the Jew, the self-pride of the Jew, the confidence, the majesty of us will be restored. We won't all become lambs. We won't all become sheep. We will become lions and sheep together. The union of Koko Yaakov and Yadayim Yedei Esav gets the bracha. It's the only way to do it. Then I'll close the poem I saw. It's a beautiful poem that was written it's a difficult poem about the after the murder of Ezra Schwartz. It's a murder that touched the hearts of many Americans because we saw one of our own, could have been one of our own children, going to Israel for the year from Boston, and he was murdered. And this, I don't know who he is. Zev Steinberg wrote this incredible and biting poem, but you'll listen why I'm reading it to you. Oh, Ezra Schwartz. If only you were Cecil the Lion, how the world would erupt in outrage and indignation at your murder. The White House would make an immediate statement condemning the shooter. Oh, Ezra, if you were Cecil the Lion, your face would illuminate the side of the Empire State Building, and media outlets throughout the country would fight for tidbits of breaking news. Oh, Ezra, if only you were Cecil the Lion, the brokenhearted masses would flock to protests and rallies, your name on tens of thousands of posters, your face on a million placards, the cacophonous calls for justice. Oh, Ezra, if you had been born a lion and not a Jew, how humanely the world would have treated you. Oh, Ezra, if you had died on a reserve and not in the Holy Land, how unconscionable your murder would be. But Ezra, dear Ezra, you Lion of Judah, with your flowing mane of chesed and giant footprints of love and laughter, the king of your realm and the pride of our pride, in your name we will never cease to roar. I think this poem encapsulates the theme we are trying to discuss here, and that is, Hadar is not a contradiction of the way of Hatikva. It must be part of that vision. And one day indeed, the lion won't have to gnash his teeth, but he will be part of that totality of the vision of the lion and the lamb together as part of a strong and proud Jewish future. Thank you very much.